Welcome to the Apologia podcast, the audio-only archive of the Apologia YouTube channel. Note that some content was designed to go with visuals, but the imagination can be a powerful thing. If you enjoy the podcast, please consider giving it a 5-star rating on the podcast app you're using now to help us reach more people. Or, since this endeavor is ad-free, consider going a step further and supporting us for as little as $1 a month at patreon.com/apologia. But for now, let's get to the episode. Part of the Apologetic series, posted September 22, 2023, titled Dead Sea Scrolls, What Apologists Hope You'll Never Find Out, featuring Dr. James Tabor.
Jesus. Dead Sea Scrolls.
Hey, you got your Jesus in my Dead Sea Scrolls.
You got your Dead Sea Scrolls on my Jesus.
What? Delicious.
You can study the scrolls, you can study Jesus, but put them together is just fascinating.
Welcome to Apologia, where a former Christian takes a look at the claims of Christians. Today, I'm pleased to be joined once again by Bible scholar, Professor Dr. James D. Tabor.
Good to be with you again.
James was formerly at UNC Charlotte, but is now spending his retirement educating enthusiastic regular people like you and me. He is one of 10 all-star speakers at the imminent New Insight into the New Testament conference, which you can still sign up for and maybe see me hanging around.
Is that right? Good. Yeah. I'm going to talk about the Gospel of Mark. Moving the goalpost. It has to do with apocalypticism and say, well, we weren't wrong. Look, the goalpost is up here. You say, yeah, but you had it here first. I'm not sure we'll count that touchdown. Sorry.
And he's also got a brand new course on the Dead Sea Scrolls, which is coincidentally the topic we're going to be talking about today.
Jesus and the Dead Sea Scrolls. I take what we know of Jesus and his followers and I compare it to the Dead Sea Scroll community. They have some real similarities. People have tried to say, yeah, but there's all these differences. And there are. But that does not in any way remove the parallels. So that's what we do in the course. We explore every aspect of that in 10 lectures. We take you through it in a good way, just like we would with undergrad students. But very accessible to people.
I know you prefer the realm of scholarship. But here on my channel, we live in the world of Christian apologetics. As you know, some Christians love to exaggerate about the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yeah, it's just crazy. It's crazy stuff.
We've got several apologists today, so buckle up.
Okay, I'm going to ride with you. So,
starting with Sean, the younger McDowell, who admits that he leans toward theatrics when faced with ambiguity.
The Dead Sea Scrolls help us to answer the question of why we can trust the Bible. The discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls took place in early 1947. Three Bedouin shepherds, boys who were really cousins, were exploring in the mountainous area northwest of the Dead Sea. And one threw a rock inside this cave and they heard pottery shatter. So they decided they were gonna come back the next day and explore it. Well, one of the cousins got up early by himself and he's actually been called the Wolf, went up there early, climbed over, went down inside, and found a jar that had been shattered, and inside it were a bunch of scrolls. He was disappointed to come across a few ancient scrolls. He had no idea that these scrolls would be worth millions of dollars and turn the archaeological and biblical world upside down.
That is so fascinating. I've heard some of the different stories and always wondered exactly what do we know, and maybe this is just a part of some of the folklore that it's been told differently, and maybe we can't have the precision that we're looking for, but the Bedouin throwing a rock is the coolest, most interesting one. So I'm going with that one.
Well, this finding treasure in caves is a kind of a trope or an idea that you find in lots of literature. But in this case, we do know something about the Bedouin tribe. We think it was the summer of 1946. And the young boys that initially made the discovery were interviewed by John Trevor. He was in Jerusalem at the time, and Kondo, who's the dealer. So I think the basic framework of the story is correct. Now, stories can always get sensationalized, like, were they looking for a lost sheep or something like that? Did they throw a rock in and hear something break? That could be an excited tale of a kid telling something because he doesn't want to get in trouble as he comes home with this trove of manuscripts. But there's no doubt they came from that cave. And then when the archaeologists and the scholars went out to what's called Cave 1, that's the one that was discovered by these Bedouin, they found ample evidence that backed up their story. There are tin jars in the cave, all sorts of fragments of scrolls because it had been sort of rummaged through. But they did find in one of the jars, and that's what the boys began to take to the market in Bethlehem and try to sell it, 6 scrolls that are particularly important, complete copy of Isaiah, the community rule, which is the charter of the community, very valuable. They're substantial scrolls, pretty complete, and they were there. And I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Speaking of that complete Isaiah scroll, Sean's father, Josh McDowell, is one of many Christians who overstate the extent to which it can attest to a reliable transmission of the Old Testament.
They were absolutely amazed at the accuracy, over a 1,000-year gap with the accuracy of the scroll from 900 AD with the scroll of Isaiah of 125 BC. In fact, in one chapter of 166 words in Isaiah, in 1,000 years of transcription, there were only 3 letters that were different. And it was a letter that made up the word light after 1,000 years. This is one reason why I just came to the obvious conclusion to me that I could take the scriptures, hold them in my hand, and say, thus saith the Lord.
It's very, very upsetting to me to hear that. He should know better. First of all, one chapter, I think there's 66 chapters. Maybe we should look at them all. And I think he must know this. But then when he draws this vast conclusion that we can be sure we're reading the same Isaiah, that's simply incorrect. I've got here, anybody can get it, the Dead Sea Scroll Bible. This is an English translation of all of the scrolls from Qumran, from the Dead Sea Scroll caves, in English. And when you open it up, you can see the changes there. I think there's more than 3. And I just picked a random page. I'm in Isaiah 43 and 44. And wow, 17 changes on one page. You say, yeah, but it's just like 3 letters. No, it's not 3 letters. It's like one text says, in you, or transgressions, or not remember your sins. And the other text will say something entirely different. So either he doesn't know this, I would like to think that, he's just not aware of it. Maybe some professor told him this in some seminary he went to or something. Or he does know it. And if he does know it, it is extremely upsetting to me because people want to hang on to this. And if it's grossly inept, then I think that's a moral issue. Whatever people want to believe about the Bible, they should form it with the facts. And in this case, you've got the Greek translation called the Septuagint. You've got the Masoretic text, the traditional text that's in everybody's English Bible today. And you've got the Dead Sea Scrolls. So you would have to be aware of all of that if you're going to be honest and then form your views of the Bible. But you wouldn't take just the Greek and say, oh, God inspired that. I'll never look at the Masoretic. Or I'll take the Masoretic, but I would never look at the Greek. And now you have copies that are 1,100 years older than the Masoretic, and there are significant differences. I mean, I can give you examples if you would like one. I'll give you my favorite example.
Sure, let's do it.
This is in Deuteronomy 32. It's called the Song of Moses. This is the Masoretic text. If you open any English Bible, you'll tend to get this, unless it's a modern translation that is adapted and adopted the newer readings. Okay, when the Most High divided the nations, their inheritance, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the bounds of the people according to the number of the children of Israel. Now, that's King James Version, RSV, ASV, NIV, all of them, Masoretic texts. Listen to this, Dead Sea Scrolls. When the Most High divided the nations, their inheritance, he separated the sons of Adam. He set the bounds of the people according to the number of the sons of God, the B'nai Elohim. They're mentioned in Psalm 86. This is that angelic council of the Most High where the Elohim, the gods, sit around and they discuss things. Look it up in Psalm 82. Now, What are we going to do with that? The Septuagint, by the way, agrees with the Dead Sea Scrolls against the Masoretic text. So here we've got two textual traditions that agree with one another, and the one everybody thinks is inspired by God doesn't agree. And also, if you start analyzing it academically, which you should, it's not skeptical to want to deal with facts. You know, what you finally decide about your faith or anything can vary, but get the facts straight. And what would be the best guess as to why the Jewish Masoretic text takes out the B'nai Elohim? Because they sound like it's polytheistic. Like God's got these other gods that he said, I'll put you over Persia and I'll put you over Greece. And that's exactly what you get in the book of Daniel. If you remember in the book of Daniel, one of the angels says, I was fighting with the guy who's over Persia and it took me 21 days to take him down. But now I'm here to give the revelation to you, Daniel. Well, this is reflecting a culture of the time. And there are honest evangelicals like the late Michael Heiser who at least dealt with that, and they did deal with the facts, and he didn't misrepresent those readings. He considered them. But there are lots of others who, unfortunately, like this quote, that it's just so historically inaccurate. Does it make a difference? Well, it's two different readings, and it's two different views. I would certainly think that the Dead Sea Scroll reading is the original. If you want to know, well, what went back to the oldest tradition when Deuteronomy was written, it's got to be the B'nai Elohim, because we have so many other references to them. And now they're kind of written out of the story because it sounds like, oh, there's other gods. We can't have that. But they're all over the Hebrew Bible if you studied it. How about Genesis 6? The sons of God saw the daughters of men. It's the same phrase.
To his son Sean's credit, his guest Anthony Ferguson also corrected this overstatement from Father Josh.
Well, oftentimes what apologists do, and I've been guilty of doing this, is draw from the book of Isaiah conclusion about the copying over 1,000 years without maybe putting this in context to some of the other books that are in the Dead Sea Scrolls and some of the larger stories.
What's not safe is to say, well, because that's true, therefore the Old Testament has been copied reliably. And, you know, it should be clear why that's not a safe conclusion to draw. Based on that one piece of evidence, right? Because 1Q Isaiah A is not a manuscript of the entire Old Testament. It's just Isaiah. So it doesn't say anything about the copying of Jeremiah. It doesn't say anything about the copying of Ezekiel. It's just a manuscript of Isaiah.
In an entirely other sphere of apologetic Dead Sea Scroll overextension, we have Dr. John Bergsma. Are you familiar with his work?
I know his name, but I don't know his work, no.
He's a Catholic apologist, and he makes some rather bold assertions about John the Baptist and his affiliation with the Dead Sea Scroll community.
Everything that is said about John the Baptist in the Gospels has some kind of resonance with the Essene movement. And yeah, so to go right on down the line, there's so many things. First of all, there's geographic proximity. At no point in that stretch of the Jordan River are you more than a day's walk from the monastery that is at the site at Qumran. We notice that when John is questioned about his identity, he appeals to Isaiah 40, verse 3. A voice cries, "In the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord." It's not an influential passage in broader Judaism, but then you have the monks and you have John the Baptist both making very prominent use of that verse to justify their existence. But then a particular aspect of John's ministry that seems to point to him having been expelled from the community is the fact that he's eating off the land. You have that curious statement in Mark and Matthew that he was eating locusts and wild honey because they had taken vows not to eat food prepared outside the community. And so guys that got kicked out had to eat grass or whatever they could find. They could not eat prepared foods. And that's what it appears that John the Baptist is doing. So there may have been one or two, you know, as many as four of the apostles may have had a background in Essenism prior to following Jesus.
I wouldn't go that far, and I'll tell you why. Because you're talking about a community that spread over a period of over 100, 150 years. They last all the way up to the destruction of Jerusalem in 70. That's when these scrolls we think were hidden away. And some of them date into the period of the first century in terms of radiocarbon dating. So the group is out there. But as you begin to read the scrolls, you begin to uncover a certain strictness that basically would make Jesus and John as co-workers, as cooperating together in the same kind of an apocalyptic messianic movement, very alien to this group. Now, that's not to say there aren't similarities. For example, both groups talk about, I would describe them like this, apocalyptic, messianic, preparing the way in the wilderness, new covenant, children of light, immersing in water as initiation, a prophet like Moses, council of 12, selling your possessions. So if that's all I told you, you would think, wow, let's throw Jesus in. Why just John the Baptist? I mean, Jesus is teaching him many of these same things that I just named. New covenanters, children of light, those phrases are only used in the scrolls and in the New Testament. Apostle Paul uses children of light. Jesus uses it in the Gospel of John. So, you know, why pick John the Baptist? There's this idea that he's this kind of rigid guy out in the desert and he's strict and Jesus is liberal. And yet if you have the tiny little snippet of teachings of John that survive, you know what he says? Let him who has no bread share with him who has none. Let him who has two coats share with him who has one, and so forth. Sounds kind of like Sermon on the Mount stuff. And that's Absolutely. In the Q source that we have of John's teaching. So I would say that John and Jesus are parallel to this movement, but they're much later than the scrolls. The scrolls were written in the early part of the movement. If an apocalyptic movement goes through a period of disappointment, of prophecies and expectations failing, you have a second, even a third generation, there can be a sense of kind of loosening up on things. I think we see it with groups like Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, Seventh-day Adventists. You know, they all go back to the 1830s, 40s, 50s. But today, they've had to make adjustments. You know, we don't have a clear handle on what people at Qumran were saying, let's say, in 30 CE, when Jesus was around or when John the Baptist was around. They could have developed in ways that don't reflect the earlier scrolls that we're reading. I usually say to my students, I don't think either one is a card-carrying member. And based on what the scrolls say, they're very, very strict. And I don't see any indication that John is sharing those sort of views of segregation. He talks to Roman soldiers. He talks to non-Jews. He talks to tax collectors and sinners, as they're called. Seems to address the same kind of broad audience that Jesus did. And so I wouldn't agree with that, but I don't want to play down the parallels. That's what my course is about, Jesus and the Dead Sea Scrolls. There's strong differences and also strong similarities.
Well, on the opposite side of the pendulum is Dr. Craig Evans.
I know Craig very well. We've actually excavated together in Jerusalem. So,
well, Dr. Evans was recently asked about the connections between John and Jesus and the Dead Sea Scrolls that it seems you're putting forth.
He says, how does this discovery affect the claim that the Qumran community worshipped an early version of Jesus, a teacher of righteousness who died, rose from the dead, and then ascended into heaven?
Now, since the scrolls were first found, people have played with this idea that maybe Jesus was from Qumran, maybe he was an Essene, maybe some of his followers were, maybe the Dead Sea Scrolls refer to him, on and on it goes. I don't subscribe to any of that, and mainstream scholarship does not either.
Is your work outside the mainstream?
Well, there is a tendency, I think, among all of us to emphasize the differences because the two movements are not identical. So if both talk about the new covenant, one could have a different view of the new covenant and what it includes than the other. If both are messianic, apocalyptic, share their goods in common, practice ritual initiation, there can be differences, and there are differences. But the matrix is worth talking about. I think he might be, and I know Craig really well, he's a friend of mine, I think he might be referring more to this oversimplified idea of, oh, death, burial, resurrection. Yeah, they believe that too. I do think that there is evidence in the Thanksgiving hymns, and quite a few scholars agree with this. These were written partially, we think, by the teacher himself, that he does say in the first person, I've ascended to heaven. I've taken my seat among the gods. And that could start sounding like his projection of himself, like the Apostle Paul talks about ascending to heaven. Jesus talks about ascending to heaven in some of the traditions of the New Testament. But he's probably reacting against this too rigid of a pattern, which I would also agree with. But I don't think we should play down the parallels. The way I usually say it, I list out these parallels, 10 or 12, and then I usually make the point. None of these 12 apply in any way to the Pharisees or the Sadducees, the other two groups that we know something about. Okay. Well, if none of them apply, but all 12 apply to the Jesus movement and the scroll group, we do have something to talk about. And that's what my course is about. But I do think the strict version of the Qumran group that we get in the early traditions of the scrolls, like the community rule or the Damascus document, two of the documents we cover in the course, they would not have liked Jesus. They might go, hey, you got new covenant, you're messianic, you're apocalyptic and all that. But, you know, if we have a lamb fall in a ditch on the Sabbath, we're not going to get up and help it out because that would take a lot of work. And it's more important to obey God and rest on the Sabbath than to help that lamb out of the ditch. And Jesus actually addresses that in the Gospel of Luke. He says, is there somebody that wouldn't help an animal out of a ditch on the Sabbath? Well, he wouldn't even have said that. And yes, there were people like that. And he's trying to shame them. He also says what goes into the mouth doesn't defile. And then he makes a joke. It's mistranslated as, thus he declared all foods clean so that people can eat pork and shrimp. That's not what he's talking about. He's actually, if you read the Greek, he says, it goes into your mouth, through your intestines, out your rear end, into the toilet. It's translated draught in the King James, into the drain. It's actually a joke. Like the defilement you're worried about, you flush it down the toilet. But the defilement you should worry about is the heart. Now, on the other hand, when you read the scrolls and the Thanksgiving hymns, there is plenty of devotion, of spirituality. For example, I'll quote you the prayer, just the first lines of the prayer in the community rule. Before I move my hands and feet, O Lord, I praise you for your goodness. Things like that. That's all the way through the scrolls. But on the other hand, as far as strict interpretations of the Torah, like if a commandment says this, how do you interpret the way to keep that? They're going to take the hard line. If you remember the story of the two Pharisees, Hillel and Shammai. Shammai was strict and rigid, and Hillel was kind of like Jesus, you know, pretty accommodating to human need. The scroll group in the early scrolls that we have, they would make Hillel look really liberal like Jesus. And Shammai, I think they would think, you're kind of leaning that way. You need to be a little more strict. You can't go to the latrines or the toilet on the Sabbath. Why? Because a Sabbath day's journey is 2,000 cubits, and you got to put the toilets 3,000 cubits outside the camp. And you're not allowed to go outside the camp on the Sabbath, so you got to hold it. Josephus mentions that, by the way, with admiration for their dedication. He calls them Essenes. Well, I think Jesus would have just, you know, shrugged at that, like, come on. But they're worried about ritual defilement. They're worried about touch not, taste not, handle not, and so forth, as many halakhically observant Jews are today. So it really depends on the world that you're in. And I would not want to characterize any Jew today who's highly observant of a strict Orthodox Judaism as having no heart, no spirituality, no joy, because the ones I know do in fact have that. But they also believe you should keep the Torah. So I think that Jesus would have a more accommodating and open view. He said things like, the Sabbath is for people, not people for the Sabbath. So let that guide your interpretation. I think the Dead Sea Scroll group would have said, what? No, the Sabbath's for God, not for us. What are we? We're mere worms, you know, looking to God. Well, Jesus had a different idea.
So it sounds like if you want to find out why apologists are wrong about the Dead Sea Scrolls, people should sign up for your new course.
Well, what you need to do is read the scrolls. Everybody loves the scrolls, right? The oldest things we've ever, wow, this is amazing. And you say, have you read them? I haven't had time to read them yet. But you know, it's kind of daunting. Here's the book we use. It's 600 pages. We don't claim to cover all 600. But if I gave you a Bible and you've never heard of the Bible, and I say, why don't you study the Bible here? And you don't know, well, what comes first and who wrote what and what's the chronology and what's the history. So you really do need a course or a teacher to take you through, and that's what we do. Yeah, I want people to read the scrolls for yourself and you're going to get the good, the bad, and the ugly. And don't you get that in the Bible as well? I mean, you got lots of stuff where you think, oh, wait a minute, really? Is that what it says? And the scrolls are the same way. I mean, I could give you examples on both sides. But I would say, yeah, the good scholars that are well-informed about the scrolls, they don't want to overemphasize the parallels because it can sound like Jesus copied the teacher of righteousness. But if I can list 25 things that the teacher taught and Jesus taught, and no other Jewish group taught them, there is something going on there, and we shouldn't just ignore that and say, oh, well, it's kind of the same, but it was different. Yeah, it was different, but there's a matrix or a culture, and particularly the idea of a community of the end of days, a community that thinks they're going to live to see the end. You behave differently all the way through if you think you're the last generation, and they did.
If you're interested in signing up for Jesus and the Dead Sea Scrolls, go to tinyurl.com/TaborDSS. That's TaborDSS, as in Dead Sea Scrolls. And by doing so, you'll get lifetime access to not only all 10 lectures, but also regular Q&A Zoom calls for questions and discussion. And you'll be helping this channel and its mission.
I want to make it as much like a college course as possible.
Excellent. Thank you for your time, Dr. Tabor.
Thank you very much.
And for more of this former Christian taking a look at the claims of Christians, tap on the thumbnail on screen now, and I'll see you over there. As always, to my amazing patrons, whose support makes my work possible. If you can join them, please find the link in the description. Until next time, later.